Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Welcome back. At this point, we should go around and say our names. I'm George.
Alex.
Please.
Ryan.
Scott.
Jerry.
Stephen.
My name is Jeff.
Matthew.
I'm Brad.
Bob.
My name is Cass.
I'm Jim.
Jim.
And I'll introduce JD. There it is. JD Doyle, our speaker today, serves as a core teacher at East Bay Meditation Center and has served as a board member and was the co-founder of the LGBTQI Meditation Group. JD is in the Spirit Rock Meditation Center Teacher Trainer Program and was in the Dedicated Practitioner Program and the Community Dharma Leader Program. JD has practiced Buddhism since 1995 in the US, Thailand, and Burma. For over 25 years, they worked as a public school teacher focusing on issues of equity and access. JD holds a bachelor's degree in environmental studies from Cornell University and a master's degree in language and literacy and sociocultural studies from the University of New Mexico. JD identifies as gender nonconforming. They. Welcome, JD. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. Well, that was quite the introduction, and it's actually, it's been quite a while. So I've actually graduated from that teacher training that I was in 2020. So that was a while ago. And it's wonderful, you know, that we continue to grow and change. And it's kind of funny when you hear yourself encapsulated like that. So thank you. I actually want to start off by just acknowledging that we are on Ramatush Ohlone land here in San Francisco. And this has become part of one of the ways that I ground myself in places. And partly because I have learned about how important it is for me to honor those people who have come before me and those people who will come after. And so this is part of this way I see myself as how we inter-are, as Thich Nhat Hanh has said. And so I just really want to honor the Ramatush Ohlone here in San Francisco. And also really want to start by honoring the lineage that I teach in as well. First, I want to honor that I have a very queer lineage and that I was started learning about Theravadan Buddhism through an amazing teacher in New Mexico, Eric Kolbig, who it turns out grew up near where I did in New England, and so we both found our way to New Mexico. And then I also had another queer teacher, Arita Weissman, who many of you know, and then Larry Yang. And so I've had many teachers, but I really want to honor not only this lineage that goes back 2,600 years, but this lineage of queer teachers that has taken these liberatory teachings and specifically named how we as queer people can use and can explore and integrate these really amazing teachings into our lives. So I wanted to share today about kind of this way that we can have a radical reorientation to our lives, how we orient ourselves in our lives. And so I'm interested in this because it feels so disorienting right now. Everything feels like there's so much. And so it just feels like, you know, climate crisis, histories and legacies of racial injustice, the attack on trans folks, the attack on, you know, women. There's so many ways that there's just all of these, you know, crises just boiling over, if you will. And so this reorientation is like, how do we both claim our ways of living and let go at the same time? So any good Buddhist will know there's like, you can't, it's like some sort of koan in there. You have to like sort of like have a perplexion to kind of get started. It's also very queer, so it's wonderful we're here. So I had a really amazing opportunity the last couple of months that I was able to teach and practice in New Mexico at a retreat center called Vallecitos, so the Little Valley. And it's up in northern New Mexico in the middle of the Carson National Forest. And so one of the things about that, being able to practice, is the night sky. And those of us who live in the city, you know, the night sky is something that gets obscured so often by the lights and the, you know, clouds, just everything. And so just this, the thing that I'm really holding or really allowing to sink in is the night sky in practicing in northern New Mexico. And the first retreat was an LGBTQIA retreat in Andy M. Last night there, we had a song circle, and it was so beautiful. It was a community-led song circle where the teachers, you know, just opened it up and the community led it. And at one point, you know, the moon rose up and we all got quiet and just watched this valley, like, hold the big moon and the amazing just power of just pausing and being with this cycle of nature of which we are a part, and this way that we can orient ourselves. And then the other thing that happened during that song circle was at one point there was this coyote call and response. It was amazing. We were singing and then the coyote started howling, and then we chanted some more, and then the coyote started howling. And really, you know, these connections that we can have to other than human world is really extraordinary. And then I was able to go back just this month, so I've been back a couple weeks ago. I was out there, and not only was I able to watch the moon rise a number of times, but on the night of the full moon, the harvest moon, I was actually woke up early enough in the morning that I was able to watch the moon set, the moon rise and the moon set. And there was a way in that cyclical experience of like really following the moon that I was like, had a way of remembering a part of myself that I kind of had lost. It was kind of like a reorientation. And there's also this invitation to slow down, you know, just like to, like, just to, like, there's something, like, the power of watching the moon in such a beautiful place is really extraordinary, and yet there's nothing really much happening. And yet all of a sudden the moon's up above, you know, there's really not much happening. And this is just this way of, like, allowing that pause, allowing the beauty and the awe to sink in. And then, being human, I was in this, you know, wonderful room with these big windows, and I was so annoyed because I couldn't sleep. The moon was so bright. I was like, oh my God, I'm not sleeping. You know, and this funny thing is, like, I didn't want to be awake. I wanted to be asleep. You know, I actually wanted to be asleep. And it was like that for many nights because the moon was really quite bright. And I was really thinking about this as this way of like, wow, you know, it's okay if I'm not sleeping all through the night. You know, it's okay. You know, what is there for the moon? Like, maybe the moon's trying to tell me something, you know. Maybe there's something else going on here that I'm just really not getting. it actually ended up being okay, but it was really interesting that at one point I could have something, this is so beautiful and so amazing, and the next moment I'd be like, can I close these curtains? Like, of course not. They were like, you know, very ill-fitted to the window. And so this place of like seeking comfort, seeking, you know, some sort of ease, like sleep, which is definitely a beautiful option for us. So not to get it wrong, like I do really treasure sleep as well. But just that metaphor as a Buddhist, like, you know, I want to be asleep, I don't want to be awake. So I want to share, this is one of my favorite poems from Izumi Shikubu, who is a Japanese poet written over 2,000 years ago. And she says, watching the moon at midnight, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. Watching the moon at midnight, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. And so this invitation into orienting ourselves to wholeness, to in this way that we can show up for all of ourselves. And I love this little poem because, you know, the moon is so solitary, and yet it's connected to everything. You know, even us, like our the tides, the water in our bodies rise and fall with the moon. And this way that we can be both alone and together, you know, that we are inseparable, and yet there is something singular about each one of us. And so for me, part of my journey in meditation and Buddhism has been really this journey towards wholeness. You know, the phrase of using this term mindfulness is another word that we can use for mindfulness, for sati, which is mindfulness in Pali, is to remember. Like just that process of remembering, coming back again and again, like we probably just did if you were like me with my restless mind during the meditation, just returning, running off, returning, remembering. And that sense of remember, like all the members, like bringing back together. I taught, as I mentioned, in public schools for many years, and when I taught fourth grade, right at the beginning down here in Castroville, artichoke capital of the world, they had a really great program called, that was all about, you know, like how do we get along with each other and all of those kind of things, which are, you know, we need to have more practice in those as adults as well. But fourth grade, and we were instructed, and I was like, it was one of those things where like I was actually instructing the kids, but I was learning for myself. And so we had this little paper doll, if you will. It was called ILAC, I-A-L-A-C, which stood for I Am Loving and Capable. And so as a teacher, I was following these directions, and I was like, wow, this is really amazing. And so I was instructed to take this paper doll and to tear it. And, you know, as an illustration of this is how we all, this is what happens to all of us. You know, we get, you know, we get bumped and bruised and torn, and people just don't see it inside of us. And then, of course, the teaching was to tape it back together, and then we're whole again. And it was an illustration that I needed, you know, for myself, too, as a teacher, like as a young person teaching, you know, think about, like, yes, it's not like my bumps, my bruises, my ways of managing and navigating the world are essential to who I am. You know, this is part of who I am. And I know, you know, at this point, I just pause because I know so many of us have lost so many, you know, through illness, through, you know, addiction, through all sorts of mental impacts of being and making our way in this world. So those of us who can remember, hold, and bring these parts of ourselves together, know that this, we are not whole other than with all of this, And that we actually carry with us some of these people or beings or that we may have lost. You know, we are whole with them. And so most of the time, you know, when we're orienting ourselves in the world, there's a way that we can just orient ourselves to, you know, what brings us security, what brings us comfort. And then we can think about, you know, like, how do I just hold on to that? Like, once we get the security, then we have to sort of build up around it. You know, we have this little security, and then it's like, ooh, then all of a sudden it's mine. You know, because once we get security, then it's going to go. And so then we have to start protecting that security, protecting ourselves. And it really becomes this interesting place of investigating, you know, what it is that I need, you know, what is the care and well-being of this one here, and what is it that I think is going to protect me? What is it that I think, that I imagine, that society has told me it is what we need?
Oh, I can get it.
Sorry, I forget it. This is my favorite book these days, and so I'm going to grab it here. Let's share some from it. You can see it over there. There we go. So this is called Hospicing Modernity, and it's by Vanessa Machado de Oliveira, who is a Brazilian teacher, author, professor, educator as well. And so this is a way of looking at our world, and this using this term hospicing. So, like, how do we know that things are not working anymore, and yet we don't just want to kick them to the curb, you know? Like, how do we really honor this world that we live in? So I want to share some words from that, and then just kind of, like, offer a Buddhist perspective as well. So here's a quote from her, from Vanessa, and she says, "We are living off of expired or expiring stories. Stories that expire can no longer dance with you. They are lethargic or stuck. They can't move things in generative ways anymore. But we often feel we cannot let them go. Many of these expired stories give us a sense of security, purpose, and direction, precisely because they seem stable and solid. Thus, we become attached to them and get used to their weight in our lives." So I love this idea of these stories kind of being alive and that we're dancing with them. And this sense of vitality, like that we can kind of feel into the aliveness of our stories. And then we can see their stories still have that energy, that we can still dance with them. And at the same time, recognizing that to be human, there's this real pull towards wanting security, to wanting stability, and that weightiness in and of itself, there's something there. Like, there's something there that we want, and yet, that's where we can get stuck. And the sense of expiring, which is kind of like this exhale, you know, in our expire, and we let go. And how hard it is to let go, because, as she says, many of these expired stories give us a sense of security, purpose, and direction, precisely because they seem stable and solid. And so in Buddhism, there's this real tenet of encouragement for us to look at the impermanence of things. And so to see how things are always changing. And so this force and this way, this tendency that we as humans are to wanting to hold on to something, and that ultimately, you know, there's not anything to hold on to, that we really are in this flow, you know, like this body, you know, that's always changing. There's nothing to hold on to. And that when we try to encapsulate that body and make it be a certain way, that is where, you know, suffering. So the first truth of the Buddha is that, you know, none of us can escape suffering, that there's suffering is part of the world. And then the second truth is this craving and this way that we're trying to stop and fix something just this way. This craving is, you know, the cause of suffering. So then when we cling to this idea of security, the concept of security that's built on projections or built on kind of keeping ourselves away and separate, you know, there's going to be suffering in there. And so when we think that there's a way that we can hold, there is something to hold on to that is going to be fill in the blank, be the answer, you know, there's going to be some suffering. And so there's this place of letting go, over and over again that we encounter. And it can be really scary. It can be really scary because, like, how do we? The world is, you know, the world is changing, and it can be changing at such a rapid rate that, like, how do we orient ourselves? And yet, when we kind of hold on to a sense of security, that could be isolating as well. So I'm going to share another quote from Hospicing Modernity, and she says, Vanessa Machado de Oliveira says, "We don't realize that when the stories expire, their vitality is already gone. And if their vitality is gone, we're also stuck, because our vitality comes partly from the stories moving things in the world within us. If we want to get unstuck, we need to put these expired stories to rest. But before that happens, we need to prepare to receive their final teachings, which are the deepest, gloomiest, and sometimes also the funniest. The next step is to figure out a way to release the stories and for at least a minute to sit in the mystery of the void we fear." So I think this reorientation towards vitality is really helpful, because reorienting that which makes us feel alive. Because as long as we're still breathing, we're still alive. But if our aliveness comes from the body running or the body jumping or, you know, whatever the body could do, may not be able to do now, or even the mental capacity, if the vitality comes from this articulation of being able to say things a certain way, or the body comes from me being able to accomplish something, there's always going to be some suffering in there. But if we can come from this aliveness, and our aliveness comes so much from our relationality, our relationship to ourselves, our relationship to others, our relationship to difference, to confusion, to beauty. And so if we want to get unstuck, we can let go of these places where we're trying to concretize, that we can awaken to ourselves, to these places that, you know, we're receiving gifts and we're like, oh no, that's not a gift. That's the one I want over there. Let's just keep going in that direction. And I love that she says, she has a really amazing wordsmith, and she says, you know, sometimes the gloomiest and also the funniest. I grew up Irish Catholic, so I totally relate to the gallows humor. And so I wanted to share a story about my dad. It's not that funny, but my dad died. I wanted to share the story because when I was trying to think, it was like, what would be the gloomiest and that was funniest? And I remembered the story, and so I was like, well, there we go. And so my dad died in 2005, and I was able to be there with him for much of the last few months, him and my mom. And so some of my siblings, my mom and I, gathered around, and we were there with my dad the night that he died. And then after, you know, we did all those things, and I ended up just having some time where I was alone with my father in the room, and his body had passed, and I was kneeling at the bedside next to him, and I was talking to him, you know, like internally. I wasn't out loud, but I was talking to him, and I felt like this incredibly deep connection, and I really felt like I was like, we were just communicating on this level. And then my older sister, I heard the shriek, and she was in the hall, and she looked in. She was like, "I thought you were talking to Dad." And I was like, "I was." And then she's like, "Well, the Undertakers are here." And so the Undertakers were here, and it was October, so it was the 17th of this month. And so and the Undertakers, it was so funny because it looked like they had gone to like a Halloween store, and they got like Undertaker costumes. They had these huge like trench coats that seemed too big for them, and these shoes that were like shiny black shoes. But also, I was like, "Oh my God, how are they going to walk in those shoes?" And then they came up, and they had this covering that totally looked like the 70s. They had like this, it was a denim, but it wasn't even like 100% cotton denim. It was like mixed, you know, poly cotton denim. And they put this denim thing over my father on the board, on the stretcher. And then this, and I don't know why I found this so funny, but this little denim had a little pocket on it in front where they put the death certificate. And so then they carried, so they, my, the stairway was kind of, you know, kind of had a couple turns in it. And so then these guys in these big jackets carried this, you know, my dad down the stairs. And I was just like, "Oh my God, they're totally going to drop it." Because they were like, it looked like they just pulled a couple guys off the street, you know, and "These are your clothes, and come on up and do this. We need some extras." But it was just really funny because it was just like this, it just felt so incongruous to this experience that I had been having on this other plane moments before, to have these guys come in and put this, you know, fake denim thing on my dad and carry him down the stairs and out into town, you know. And it was so, it was really, really funny just to have this image in my head. And I was just like, and yet, you know, that's what happened. And so there was a way that that intimacy, just allowing, you know, this process of being there with my dad's death, which was, you know, nothing that I ever wished would happen, but I don't have any control over, has provided me with a way of knowing in the world that I wouldn't otherwise have access to. And I know a lot of you have sat through and been side by side with people or beloved beings in death. And it's not anything that we wish. And yet, if we can show up for these times, it's like adding compost, you know, to your flower garden. Like, you know, it doesn't smell very good, but the flowers, wow, they love it, you know? And so can we, in this orientation, begin to not shy away from that which is uncomfortable? Can we bring this wholeness, share these stories? Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, has said, "No mud, no lotus." So you'll hear bringing him in again today. And he says, "Most people are afraid of suffering, but suffering is a kind of mud to help the lotus flower of happiness grow. There can be no lotus flower without the mud." Most people are afraid of suffering. That's part that we can't bypass, because fear is a really important thing for us to know. And at the same time, it's important for us to know when we shouldn't believe it. So some things are important for us to be afraid of. We wouldn't be alive if we didn't know fear. But the way that we orient towards fear, can we know it with our that same kind of intimacy? Can we know fear? Can we know discomfort? And can then, when we respond from our wholeness, not from a getting rid of, clinging to something, but to bring it in and know what it means to be alive? I mean, if Thich Nhat Hanh says most people are afraid of suffering, you know, I mean, he really knows it. But suffering is a kind of mud to help the lotus flower of happiness grow. So it's not like we get to live without that suffering. And yet so many of us are trying, you know, bigger cars, bigger houses, bigger jobs, bigger, you know, whatever. And, you know, that's where happiness is. And so what if it's not? You know, maybe some happiness there, but what's this true happiness? What's the orientation? So, continuing on in this quote from Vanessa Machado de Oliveira, and she says, from the last one, where she was kind of like, the next step is to figure out a way to release the stories and for at least a minute sit in the mystery of the void we feared. So to look into this fear, you know, what is it made out of? What is that place? And in Buddhism, you know, we might call it the void, we might call it emptiness, you know, empty of self, empty of all of these things that we can create ourselves. And she says, this is where we might discover that our forecast was wrong, our prediction was wrong. We might find that the void consists of both nothingness and everything else, and that it can be an unlimited source of serenity, sanity, energy, and inspiration. I love this. We might find that the void consists of both nothingness and everything else, and that it can be an unlimited source of serenity, sanity, energy, and inspiration. And I find this sentence about being both nothingness and everything else so such a wonderful phrasing, because one of the places that I have encountered in Buddhism that I feel like is a really a dead end is this desire for transcendence. You know, this place of like that moment in your meditation, or that moment with the full moon, or that moment where we recognize that there's an emptiness there. That just, it's so precious, where there's the sacred. It's like we connect with that divinity, the sacredness. And at the same time, on the other side of that coin, inseparable from that, is everything else. But if we try to hold on to that transcendence, just like anything else, if we have a preference for transcendence, it's also a preference. It's going to go away. And I'm sure there are many people here who have also found the emptiness in everything else. You know, like in the midst of it all, can we also find that preciousness? Can we also find that exhale, the inhale, that breathing place of serenity in the midst of it? And so this place of needing them both, I mean, all of us are here, which is when we spend 30 minutes in silence and stillness, so we know there's that value to that. And in our culture, that's not always valued, and so it really is important that we find those times to watch the moon, to walk the dog, to go to the ocean, to look at the sky, to be quiet. And then also recognize when we want to hold on to that too. And different ones of us have different, you know, makeups. I mean, I spent my 20s spending at least 2 or 3 months of the year in the backcountry in New Hampshire so that I could make it through college, you know. Like, we all have different needs. And so this body needed to get away from people and be with rocks and trees and mountains, and it still does. And some other people, you know, you see them, they're at the cafe every day and they're just soaking it in and bringing it back. So we each have different ways of being in the world. Not that one is right, or how do we orient ourselves? How do we dance, as Vanessa would say? And so she says, then continuing this, she says, the last thing after we realize, you know, this forecast was wrong, that we can hang in this voidness that consists of both nothingness and everything. And then she says, the last thing is to step back into the world of stories and look for the ones both old and new that are already dancing or getting ready to dance, and that can move us towards the healing and well-being of everyone and everything eventually, whether slowly or quickly. These stories will also expire and the cycle will start again. So not giving up, you know, like allowing to see, is there still vitality here? You know, not just throwing it all out. Is there a little, you know, maybe there's a few dances left in this one. And this healing and well-being of everyone and everything. And one of the things that I think that happens with stories, I mean, and you can hear it in the stories that I'm having, is that, you know, I become the center in my stories. You know, like the stories, like mine, the story's about me, this is what I did, this is, and so what is the story when we bring in everyone? You know, so maybe it was really wonderful for me. Well, what about the rest of y'all's, you know? What happened there? And so it's part of how we heal, how we look at our impact on everyone. And, you know, just even coming here with this computer and thinking about all of the hearts and minds and hands and bodies that went into what it means to have all these minerals encapsulated in this device, bringing me lots of joy. And how do we live in this world that is so complicated that in the moment that I'm here connecting across all these devices, we also can bring in this whole world that's not here, because they are here. And so having that integrity of this interbeing, not just disregarding the mud, but getting into the mud. You know, really getting into the mud with it. How do I live with integrity? How do I orient myself in the world so that we can move towards healing and well-being of everyone and everything? So I think, you know, partly I think it's these new old stories, you know, how that we can kind of look to some of the stories that are haven't expired, that are still in these cycles, like the moon, like this poem of the moon 2,000 years ago. And one of the places I think a lot of the indigenous wisdom can be really helpful. And you hear in a lot of different people, and this is talking about how humans are seen as the younger siblings or the younger brothers or the younger sisters of trees. And you think of scientists and we think evolutionaries, like, yeah, we are. But then do we actually then look and be like, maybe that's where we should look to learning? And even in Buddhism, it's like the beginning of the Satipatthana, the foundations of mindfulness. Sit down by a tree. And then watch your breath. And then who are we breathing with, you know? So these stories, you know, like, so Robin Wall Kimmerer says, the native ways of knowing human people are often referred to as the younger brothers of creation or the younger siblings. We say that humans have the least experience with how to live and less the most to learn. We must look to our teachers among other species for guidance. Their wisdom is apparent in the way that they live. They teach us by example. They've been on the earth far longer than we have been and have had time to figure things out. I love this. And if we start looking for our teachers, I mean, I drove over the Bay Bridge today, and one of the places that I get inspiration is that there are plants growing in that pavement. Thousands and thousands of cars drive over the Bay Bridge every day. And yet, I mean, that's resilience, right? That is resilience. That is a way of being. And so this is this way that we can orient ourselves towards a way of knowing, towards an integration, not having to get rid of, but to bring it home. Bring it home. I don't know about you, but home has been a hard place to find for me in the world. And can we bring that with us? Can we find it with those around us? Adrienne Marie Brown, who is a black woman philosopher, maybe queer, I mean, she's queer, but I'm thinking maybe she's genderqueer as well. But she says, how are you willing to let yourself be changed? We know change is happening, but she says, how are you willing to let yourself be changed? How are you willing to continue to ask questions from a place of not knowing? How are you willing to be in an experimental phase instead of a permanent phase? How are you willing to be in an experimental phase instead of a permanent phase? And I love this because, you know, so often we're supposed to grow up, right? We're supposed to get rid of those experimental phases, sort of in the curiosity and the creativity and the awe and the wonder. And we're just supposed to buckle down, you know, kind of get into that adult, mature sense of being. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so grateful that I've worked with kids for so long, because there is that way that we just need to keep remembering that we're in change, that there isn't a permanent phase. There isn't a permanent phase. It's all an experiment. So, and yet there's that place where we have this longing. This longing for security, this longing for stability. And that's where this practice of coming into the present moment with as much mindfulness, as much kindness, as much friendliness, as much self-compassion for compassion for others is where I feel like it's so important. Like knowing that we're gonna wobble, knowing that the world is gonna throw all sorts of things at us, can we, even in there, hold ourselves dear and hold each other dear? Sometimes that's really hard with both self and other, but can we try? Can we try, you know? And this reorientation of how we see ourselves, and if we can see ourselves in connection, then that way of having to hold on to this security of this one here softens just a little bit. So I want to end with this quote from another author, poet, philosopher, who I feel is also instructive in sort of my education about how do I reorient myself in the world. And this is from Alexis Pauline Gumbs. And she has a really small book, and it's called Undrowned, like not drowned, Black Feminist Lessons for Marine Mammals. So for those of you who have that intersection of Black Feminism and Marine Mammals, and it's brilliant because she says, you know, we're all going to be flooded, and marine mammals are our closest kin who know how to breathe in water, so we better start paying attention. And so it's a really wonderful book about all these different marine mammals and all the adaptations that they have for surviving. And so really thinking about, well, we are mammals, and so can we be undrowned? Can we actually swim in this world with all other beings? And so this is just one of the paragraphs from that about how she thinks we can orient in the world in a way that will support us. So she says, what is the scale of breathing? What is the scale of breathing? You put your hand on your individual chest as it rises and falters all day. But what is the scale of breathing? You share air and chemical exchange with everyone in the room, everyone you pass by today. Is the scale of breathing within one species? All animals participate in this exchange of release for continued life, but not without the plants. The plants and their inverse process release what we need, take what we give without being asked. And the planet, wrapped up in the ocean breathing into the sky. What is the scale of breathing? You are part of it now. You are not alone. Thank you for your kind attention. We have some time now for some reflections, questions, comments. So we also have online or here, so however that works.
Thanks for a wonderful talk. What would you say are gay male narratives that are coming out?
Well, you probably need to ask a gay man
about your observation.
What do I think they are? Gay male narratives or what?
that have gone stale and are expired?
I really can't. I mean, I'm serious. I can't answer that because I don't know. You know, it's for each one of us to investigate for ourselves. I don't even think we can say it for a community and a group. But, you know, the thing is I think, what is it bringing, you know, what is that? So, like, we find that vitality. Like, where is the vitality? You know, where's the joy? And, you know, where's the fear? So if we investigate those, like, you know, where can we bring it, you know, how do we go about it? So I don't know.
I just meant from an observational point of view.
Yeah. I'm hopelessly, ignorant. Might be a question for the whole group, so, you know, like, maybe not everybody, but, you know, yeah, thank you. Please.
Thank you so much for your talk. It's really refreshing, and starting with the fact that you obviously have a living lineage, and which I also feel in myself, that it's alive. It's not like, oh, I'm not a guy who does and watches things. And I'm going to go here and there. There's a lie. It's a lie.
Yeah.
And it's very powerful. But you also said at the beginning you were kind of gifted to be given ways that Buddhism, these teachings, can apply to you, to us as gay people. And I don't understand what that really means. I mean, like, I identify as gay, but how are they the same teachings?
Mm-hmm.
I mean...
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, one of the places that I feel have been so important is this edge between transcendence and embodied. So, for example, a lot of people who are teachers of mine are straight, and so they think that gender is irrelevant. They think that gender, you know, and so, for example, I was on a meditation retreat in the 90s, and the hall was divided, you know, men, women, you know, so here I was sitting on the edge, like, and the teacher at the time, you know, gave this talk around, like, it's as if we're watching a movie, and you know, the girl meets the boy, they fall in love, and then the movie stops, and it's you know, and there is no girl, there is no boy. And I'm looking in the room, and I'm like, there sure as hell is. The boys are over here, the girls are over there. You know, it's right here. So, like, those of us who are going through the margins, whether it's through race or gender or sexuality, we live and we know that we can't have this transcendence, that we've got to bring it all in. And people who have privilege and comfort can transcend a lot easier. And they think, oh, I'm just going to live up here in the clouds and, you know, not in the mud like Thich Nhat Hanh says. And so that's where I think, you know, it's not that we have it easier or better. It's just that there's a way that the lineage gets queered, if you will. It gets kind of like informed by our ways of being. So that's where it's just a little more fabulous, I guess, you know. Sorry, that was an easy joke.
But then also, though, I mean, it's so essential to how we identify, right? In other words, I mean, just real quickly, I happened to, small group tour of people to India, to an ashram, and you were in the link of people who got sent to, and part of the process that happens is that they do this chant 12 hours a day. But they're rotating, first or second, I don't know who goes first, but it's males and then females. Well, I could go with that.
Right.
Like,
like, when do I get to chant?
Yeah. Well, could you chant, you know, pick, you know, this spot?
Yeah.
Like, now I feel like, you know, good.
Yeah.
It's time to chant. Right?
Yeah. Thank you for that reflection. Yeah, it's just part of, like, you know, the same thing. It's like, how do we include everyone? You know, how do we? It's really, it's an ongoing thing. And like, partly for me, it's been like looking inward. It's like, how do I include everything here too? Am I going to include everything out there? We also need to kind of get here too. So, I don't know if there's anybody on. I know you had a question, but I also, like, I'm looking for the clock around here. So I just want to keep track of time too.
Sorry, Michelle.
I saw you had your hand up, but just, is there anybody online before we go? Go ahead, please.
When you were talking at the beginning about remembering and pulling together different parts, somehow this ancient Egyptian myth about Osiris and Isis came, because Osiris was chopped into pieces by Thet, and those pieces were thrown all around the world, and Isis went and started picking them and gathering together. And interesting part and puzzling part for me that she has found all the pieces except his dick. It was really simple. Why ancient Egyptian came up with such a myth? But
thank you.
Sometimes I feel myself like, does it apply to me? But there is something about remembering pulled together, and it's also sort of, I was always that, but I just forgot. And there is always something missing, and it's kind of mystical image that doesn't translate into linear logic, but kind of rich. And
thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that, because it really is like there's a sense of like they're part of this search, this always looking for something, is that sense that something's missing. And like you were saying, it's actually like here. And also, well, different cultures have different understandings of that. So there's other stories too of that. You know, like in Buddhism, there's Kuan Yin, whose, you know, head splits open into that because, you know, thousands of pieces. And so we always are breaking apart and, you know, stitching ourselves back together. So I'm gonna go look at that story. Thank you. Appreciate it. And myths are really so such a powerful way of knowing things.
Thank you for bringing up Thich Nhat Hanh and talking about your retreat a little bit as well. It made me think about years ago I was lucky enough to be on retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, the monks and nuns in Deer Park in Escondido, and I remember coyotes and night skies with stars and walks with Thich Nhat Hanh and the monks and nuns, which was more the lotus part of the experience. But there was also the mud in that it literally rained in October. And we had to, around our tents, we had to dig trenches to keep the water from getting into the thing. So a lot of mud. And snakes, quite a few snakes in the dry time of the year. So there was both the lotus and the mud all together.
Thank you.
Brought up all those images for me.
Thank you.
Anyone else before we wrap up? Do we have a host? Thank you, JD. We have a host today?
Yes, I'm the host today, so please stay and enjoy the fellowship of the Sangha. We have some vegan treats, and there's hot water for tea. If you make tea, leave your cup in the sink, and I'll take care of it afterwards. I'll be coming around with a donable, which helps pay for this beautiful center and for our speakers and for the newsletter that goes largely to the people who are incarcerated. And around 12:30, some people gather at the front door and go to lunch. Everybody's welcome to join in there. I think that's it. There's a sign-up sheet on the credenza for anybody who wants to get on our mailing list. And check out our library of Dharma Talks online. We have over 800 now. It's a fabulous resource. And several from JD, I'm sure.
Any other announcements? Joe?
I just want to say that the last week we made it official by signing a contract for our first 5-day retreat in April of 24. Yeah, at Boston Brian, so.
April 24th.
It's 17 through the 21st. First.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Awesome.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, it's a claim to be sort of like we got the steak here or something.
Nice. Thank you so much for doing that. You and Richard, I said.
Richard and Jerry.
And Jerry, thank you.
Yeah, Steak in the Village.
I love Audrey Pine. I love to go back. Anyone else have an announcement? JD, do you want to do the dedication of Mary, or should we do ours?
I'm happy to co-create it.
Okay.
All right. Do you want to start, shall I?
Either one.
All right, I'll start. You
okay.
Can.
Okay.
Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we offer any goodness, any beauty, any merit from our thoughts, from our words, from our intentions for today, in all directions, to all beings without exception.
And by the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you.
I love the story.
I'm just wondering if being on this other plane just before seeing kind of contributed to a sense of absurdity. Like just seeing the absurdity of what we live through. And so how do you trigger that, you know, that sense of
thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.